Hello, friends. It's time once again to celebrate the birthday of our great guru, Paramahansa Yogananda. And I have had the privilege of having been his disciple for 50 years. It puts me in a especially unique position here in Europe because I don't think there's another living disciple, direct disciple of Master on this whole continent. But what this does particularly is not talk about my good fortune. It means rather something that I mentioned in a paper I wrote that most of you have probably read on the directions of Ananda, that and also on a video that I gave recently, example of Master. What would Master do in a given situation? I've heard so many different people talk about Master in a way that isn't my reality at all. I really don't think it's the reality because they've made him to seem sometimes harsh, dictatorial, too stern, a disciplinarian. Things that, yes, he would be a disciplinarian sometimes to some people, but I still remember that delightful story from the path where he was talking very ferociously, you might say, to one of the women disciples, and Jean Haupt, who was another, a man disciple, was sitting at the other end of the room, and Master was pacing back and forth like this, as if in anger. But every time he had his back turned to her and looked at Jean, he would sort of wink and smile and then turn back ferociously. And even his disciplinary methods, which were sometimes necessary, were still manifestations of love and goodwill and friendship. He was above all our friend. And I can say this with a certain conviction that others can't say who take it only from books. And some people don't say because that isn't their perception. But as a diamond can give many different lights depending on the facet that's being reflected from the light, so also a great master is very different for different people. It always amazes me even now to see those two pictures that I've sometimes mentioned. One where he's standing next to the president of Mexico, Portes Gil, his name was. And the president was a very sort of portly person and large, barrel-chested, sort of looking like this. And Master somehow, without looking like that, without being large at all, looked like him and even seemed to look large. It was a question of consciousness, not a body. But then the next picture was one so astonishingly different. Master standing next to Amelita Galikurchi. Now Galikurchi was a very frail, thin, delicate woman, old at the time the picture was taken, elderly anyway. And Master somehow, in a way that's almost unimaginable, looked like her. Now, no, he was neither large nor was he small. He was short, but he certainly wasn't frail, far from it. But somehow he looked like her. And again, I have to say that it's a matter of consciousness. And so he was really a sort of flawless mirror, as he used that expression and Kamala used it in her book. A flawless mirror to whatever person he was with or whatever situation he was in. And as I've often mentioned, he didn't take on the flaws of other people in that reflection. He was flawless also in presenting a reflection that was of people's higher nature. It was he didn't show anger if they were angry, but he would look, as it were, very calmly, reprovingly, and they would understand if they were sensitive, and those who weren't sensitive wouldn't. But I remember Master saying to me, I prefer to teach with the eyes. I don't like it when I have to scold, but those who are in tune with me understand from a look what it is that I want them to see, and how often I saw that with that look, a whole world of meaning was conveyed, a whole teaching. That aspect of Master which I see now is not necessarily limited to when I knew him, because I was still quite young. I came to him at 22, and let's see, he died in 52 before my birthday, so that would be 24 and a half, would it be? 25 and a half, I guess. Anyway, quite a young man. And I've grown over the years. And one way that I've grown in my attunement with him has been that I have tried constantly to meditate on every single thing that he said, that he did, his gestures, his tone of voice. All kinds of things were, as I've discovered over the years, a teaching. It used to be that I enjoyed telling stories about Master. Of course, I still enjoy telling stories about him, but I find that they don't come to me anymore as stories. Rather, they come as illustrations of truths that I've learned, and that whereas sometimes a story is dramatic, many times the truth was not anything dramatic at all. It could have been just a glance, just a pause in his conversation. Or he would be talking up on the stage and he'd say something that I knew was directed to me, and I'd inwardly thank him, and he would just give me a glance and smile and then go on. And it was just a momentary communication and communion with him, but so precious, and you can't tell that kind of thing as a story, and yet sometimes it means a great deal more than any story. We need to know his personality because that helps us to understand how to behave. And yet we also need to know that he was not that personality. And yet, as a human being, he was by no means a zombie or an automaton. He had a wonderful personality, and he was so kind and so humble and so generous. I've always loved that time he came back from an outing where he had wanted to, where he had been buying, in fact, a cane. And was it a cane or umbrella? I forget right now. But the man who sold him these things was just a complete stranger, not somebody Master knew. But Master felt that as long as he was spending the money of the organization, because he didn't have any money of his own, he used to keep his money in a little box, and it would enable him to get from Encinitas to Mount Washington and back. But to get off the point, and I'm famous for taking my little detours when I lecture, but I'll never forget when he wanted to give us some money. Well, he didn't say that. He said indirectly, "Isn't it awfully hot?" And we knew that what he meant was he wanted to give us some money for ice cream. So we felt awkward about saying, "Yes, yes, it's hot," like that. And so we said, "Well, it is if you say so, sir." And after sort of pushing us a little bit into saying that much of a response, he finally said, "I can't keep money and I won't. Here, take this money for ice cream." And it was just one of those little things. And so many times people reveal themselves in the little things, because when there's some big thing, some crisis to be met, some problem to be faced, then you sort of screw up your courage and act your very best. But in the normal little day-to-day things, he was still just perfection. And in a little scene like that, it was so sweet because it was so true to his nature. To get back then to this other story, and I'll have to say that yes, I do get off the subject, but almost always I remember what I got off from and come back to it. And so Master was talking about this man and how he had talked him down to a good price and so on, and was being very responsible. And then he said, gave the man more money than the man expected, or that the man asked for. And the man said, "You are a gentleman, sir," and he gave him a very nice umbrella. And when Master came back and he was talking about this experience, and he was thinking, "Oh, that poor man, he had such a shabby shop." He said, "I think I'll buy him a new carpet." Well, I'd say that a carpet cost a little bit more than a cane. He wasn't practical. He just tried to sort of act practical. But he was so generous that all he could think of was giving. And he was so kind that no matter what people did, he was so humble. I remember that Daniel Boone, who was a peculiar disciple, he had a lot of good spiritual karma. He used to have fantastic experiences. I remember walking in on his room one time, and there he was, stretched out on his bed, completely still, not breathing, lifeless. And he told later about having been taken by Master into the astral world. And he used to have all kinds of experiences. Yet he also had bad karma, and I think that Master gave him these experiences to try to save him from that. Well, his bad karma came out in negative attitudes and doubts and so on, and egotism, which finally took him off the path. And Master was concerned about it. He said that if you leave now, it'll take you 200 lifetimes to come back. And after Boone left, he said, "Well, if you work at it, you can reduce it to 7 lifetimes." But Boone didn't work at it. He feels that he's a fallen soul. And Master said, "No matter how many times you fail, you will never fail if you keep trying. God will never let you down so long as you make a real effort." But in one of Boone's moods, he wrote Master a scathing letter, in which he accused him and criticized him for all sorts of things. And Master, when he saw him again, I was present, and Master looked at him admiringly. He said, "That was the best letter Satan ever wrote me." He said, "You ought to take up writing." And that's all it meant to Master. Master didn't take it personally, but he saw that there was real skill in that man's writing. And unfortunately, Boone, with his bad karma, didn't even take up writing. He hasn't done anything with his life, and it's really a tragedy, because he's underneath it all, there's a lot of greatness in there too. But you know, we go through so many storms and ups and downs before we finally come to the point of realizing that yes, we do want God and nothing else. But Master's humility, he never put himself forward. He always let other people. I've often mentioned that thing in the autobiography of a yogi, where he was talking with Mahatma Gandhi about nonviolence, and he let Mahatma Gandhi have the last word. And yet, to us, he pointed out that nonviolence doesn't always mean, and he had said this earlier in the mosquito story with Sri Yukteswar, doesn't always mean not fighting. He said sometimes there's a need for a righteous war. But because he was talking about Mahatma Gandhi, he didn't want to upstage him, and so he left it. And I remember one time I asked him why he hadn't written about Ramana Maharshi since he'd visited him. And his answer was, "Well, Paul Brunton wrote that story." And he wanted to let Paul Brunton have the say in that, Why upstage Paul Brunton with a story that would have been deeper and more understanding? So he just let it stand like that. He was that way. He was deferential to other people. He saw greatness in everybody. And because of that greatness he drew greatness out of people who were receptive. He was noble and didn't ever, I remember Dr. Chaudhary talked about this one time. When he first came to America, many of Master's self-styled enemies warned Dr. Chaudhary against Master and told him what a terrible person he was and so on. And Dr. Chaudhary had the greatness to understand that people's opinions are not necessarily always the truth, and he didn't want to form any judgment until he met Master. But he did have the opportunity to meet Master and talk with him, and he found that Master had nothing but good to say about those people. He didn't react angrily. He didn't scold them for talking the way he knew they did. He was just very loving toward them all. And Dr. Chaudhary, after that, remarked to me, "Then I knew on whose foot the shoe fit." That kind of greatness that was always ready to forgive, always ready to let people come to the truth in their way. There's that lovely story, and actually it's an interesting fact that the encounter happens to have been recorded in a photograph. If you look at Paramhansa Yogananda In Memoriam, you'll see him talking to a Dr. Sharma, who was a chemist from India, and very successful man in his way. I believe he was the man, in fact, he was the man who invented that kind of polish they put on apples that make them sell better because they shine. But he was also petty in his little way and spoke a great deal against Master. He was, in fact, the model for the storyteller's past life in my play, The Jewel in the Lotus. And it was a true story. But at the end of Master's life, he came with the ambassador from India. And there's that moment where Master looked at him and said, "Remember, I will always love you." And you see Sharma looking very dark, guilty, deeply touched. All these things that who knows? The rest of the story I invented. I don't know whether his life was changed by it. I would think that I'd have heard something if it had been. So from then on it's imagined. But the response that I showed in that play would have been an appropriate response, because that love that Master gave was completely without condition. Now there is one thing that we need to keep in mind when we think about Master, and that is that we need to tune in to one particular ray. God has so many ways of expressing himself. And God, of course, is all sorts of things. God is in the tiger who kills the poor Indian peasant. God is in the, like that story Ramakrishna used to tell about the man who had been told by his guru that God is in you, God is in everything. And so he was walking down a jungle lane, and there was a big elephant sort of running amok. And the elephant driver on his back shouted, "Get out of the way, get out of the way." And the disciple thought, "Well, God is in the elephant, God is in me, God can't hurt God." And so he didn't move, figuring the elephant would stop. And the elephant just picked him up in his trunk and threw him aside, broke a few bones, nearly killed him. And the man managed somehow to crawl back to his guru and say, "What have I done wrong? Where did I misunderstand your teaching?" And the guru said, "Don't you understand? God is in, yes, God is in you, God is in the elephant, but don't you realize that God was also in the elephant driver telling you to get out of the way?" So we need to realize that God plays all roles in the universe, good, bad, indifferent. God is even working through Satan in a certain way to keep this universe going, to give people the tests they need in order to grow, and so on. But if we want to come to God, then we have to find a particular way. You can't climb a mountain just by sort of absorbing all the slopes. You've got to choose one slope. You're stuck with a single body, a little personality, and it's enough for you to have one path. There may be 1,000 paths up the same mountain, but it's enough for you that you find one. And so, which one? How do you discover? Well, there's a certain deep feeling that we get in our search that resonates with us. Now, I'll give you an example. I went to Pondicherry many years ago, and it was in 1959, and I didn't feel anything. Master had told me that Sri Aurobindo was a master, that he had attained Nirvikalpa Samadhi. I don't doubt it. It just wasn't my way. And Master, you remember in Autobiography of a Yogi, when he met Pranabananda, the saint with two bodies, Pranabananda was a fully liberated master. At least Master told me that. And yet, Master only felt sort of a fear in his presence. He was awestricken, he was put off, he didn't feel attracted. Now here was a disciple of Lahiri Maharshi even, something much closer, and yet it wasn't his guru. And so we need to realize that not all masters will attract us. And just again, to use Ramakrishna's example of sweetness, everybody likes sweetness, but some people like it in the form of sugar, some of candy, some of chocolate, and so on. So all of us have a deep longing for the higher self, whether we know it or not. It's always there. But some are attracted to it in some forms and some in other forms. And there have been great gurus that I have met that I was impressed, but I wasn't attracted. And Master is, I had the good luck or good karma or whatever you want to call it, to meet him without ever having met anyone else of any sort of spirituality, actually, not to speak of Masters. It was just, I read Autobiography of a Yogi and knew that was it and came to Master and have never for a moment doubted the fact that I was his disciple since then. Not everybody has that kind of good luck, but if you don't, go with what you feel. What you feel inspires you, and you will find gradually that God will lead you to the point where you do know that this is your way. Now, once you find that way, then you need to be one-pointed. There are two things here, and I talked about this morning. It happens to be December 27th, and I gave the service in our temple here in Assisi this morning, and I mentioned how, on the one hand, God is absolute, he's infinite, and so are we. But each one of us has a particular nature, an individuality that is eternally ours. And although God is infinite, he has one particular, I say it symbolically, not literally. There may be some fascinating melody that we have deep in our souls that is uniquely ours. It may be literally true. As a composer, I'm intrigued with that thought, but there's no way I could really push for it, campaign for it. But I can say that symbolically is true, that each one of us is unique, just as every thumbprint is unique, but much more deeply so. But then I mentioned another point, and that was something that Master often quoted. I think it's probably from the Srimad Bhagavatam, but I don't know. It says, all of Krishna's soldiers were like Krishna. And this is also true, that whereas every saint is somehow unique, yet our personality is composed of all sorts of vortices of thoughts and feelings and so on, and it's not really who we are. When we get down into our souls, we are unique. And yet somehow, in manifesting our personality, we do manifest in an outward way, the particular ray that is ours. I was very interested one time. I was visiting the home of Glenn and Margot Dietrich before they moved to Ananda. And I mentioned to Glenn that all of the SRF people that I know have a certain quality that you know that they're from SRF. And he surprised me by saying, well, I see that this is true also with Ananda people. And I had sort of thought, well, we were all a part of the same family. But he said, no, you're different. And I said, well, in what way? And he said, well, you're very open-minded. You are respectful of other people's opinions. He wasn't talking to me, but Ananda people in general. You have a sort of a happy attitude. You're creative. You like to try to do things better. You don't take things dogmatically. And as he went on in describing Ananda people as kind and open, I was pleased to hear this. But as I pulled back, I realized that really is the mark of people who live at Ananda. And it's not the mark of every disciple. And therefore, what it seems is that there's a certain sort of a filter that works. And just as God alone, Sister Gyanamata mentions that Rajarshi wanted to bless her and she felt his presence. She said, I knew that he wanted me to feel that it was Master working through him. But she said, I could tell the difference between Master's vibration and his vibration, his being a filter for Master, but Master would be filtered differently by the different disciples. And so all of Krishna's soldiers, in a sense, are like Krishna. All of Master's disciples, there is something that they have in common. But as I mentioned recently in my letter on decentralization, the influence is not something that comes just through meditation. When I was the leader of the center department and I went to different centers around the world and I met the center leaders and so on, I saw that they weren't at all similar in this way that I'm talking about. They all practiced Kriya Yoga. They all were very, not all, but many of them were deeply sincere. But there was something that they didn't have that all those who had known Master and lived with him did have. And so I saw that there is a certain magnetism that comes from personal contact that is really very important. You can't, from a book, clearly visualize how Master would behave or react to different circumstances. And if you look at the different disciples of Master, all of us, there really is something that is quite different from the disciples of Sri Aurobindo, from the disciples of Anandamoyi Ma, from the disciples of Ramana Maharshi. These are superficial differences, not deep-seated ones. They're not of the soul. And yet they betoken certain attitudes that Master sort of implanted in us because that was who he was. But then each one of us, being limited, will take a certain ray of that and develop it in his particular way, develop it toward more kindness perhaps, more willpower perhaps, more self-discipline perhaps, more austerity and withdrawal, more being out there with the public and working with people. because Master was all those things. And so each one, while being like Master, being a Krishna's soldier like Krishna, each one is taking also a certain ray of that. And so I look at Ananda people, and I see that they've taken that filter, which is myself, and developed it, and there is a certain similarity in all of the Ananda people who are in tune that Glenn Dietrich, as an outsider, could see quickly. Now, each one of you is going to be a filter, and as you, and you can see this in the different centers. Each center develops differently according to the people who live there, the people who are guiding the work there, and so on. This is inevitable. And if anybody complains that he doesn't think it should be so, well, live with it. It is so. You can't really expect to be to develop attitudes that are abstract. They come from the example of people who are living according to what they've gained in their lives. So it isn't that I've told people they have to be in tune with me to get in tune with Master. I'm saying that they will get in tune with Master by that attunement, and they don't have to get in tune with Master through attunement with me. They can get it in attunement with any disciple. But to get attuned to Master without having any physical contact with any disciple, this will be a kind of attunement, but it will lack that particular quality that I'm talking about that was implied in that saying, all of Krishna's soldiers were like Krishna. We, in our deeper selves, can still find God. I think that some of those disciples of Master who lived at a distance were developing deeply spiritually, but when it comes to expressing the teachings outwardly, then an attunement with someone, and of course you gain more anyway from personal contact. Master told me, in fact, that you need at least one physical contact with the Guru. That doesn't leave you out, because that contact is through channels, and those channels will continue through generations and generations. But it is something Master... See, Master talked to me a lot about these things. I don't think that he talked with others about them, because I see that they don't quote the same things, but I'm stating what I know he said. He said there has to be at least one physical contact, and yet even in his lifetime he had me give Kriya initiation to people, and yet he was the one giving that initiation through me. And that physical contact, in other words, didn't have to be with him personally, but there is a certain transfer of magnetism that comes, and you can't avoid it. It happens no matter where you are. If you are with those who will inspire and help you, you will take on something of what they are. To be a disciple of Master is to always try to look behind whatever influence you're receiving to the source. Don't look to me, don't look to Jyotish, don't look to Vidura, don't look to anybody as the truth that you're seeking. Master didn't allow people to do that with himself either. He always said, God is the Guru. He always said, I don't have disciples, you are God's disciples. So you see, the attitude of the true disciple is not personal. It is, however, focused. It's not personal because it's always seeking the truth behind, until finally it opens up and becomes infinite. At the same time, it does have to be focused. And if you think that you can get the truth by sipping at every flower, you'll find that in that dilution of attention, you won't be coming closer. The more we can tune in, especially to Master and to the way he did things and the way he thought, and anything that I can give you that is of worth will be a greater awareness of who Master was and what Master was. I don't ask you to follow me because I, first of all, I'm not somebody worth following, and secondly, because, well, you'll get much more going to the source. But I do hope that I can help bring Master to you in such a way that he becomes more real for you. If you try to do that in a vacuum, it will be more difficult. It may be possible, but it's more difficult. Take those aspects of me that remind you of him. Take those aspects of other teachers in our work that remind you of him. Don't make it personal, but try to understand that kindness and respect for others' opinions and openness to the truth rather than dogma, these are examples only of the central ray that has come down to us through all our line of gurus. If you look at all of them, each one is only trying to bring out that central ray that God brought into the world through Babaji to Lahiri Mahashay, and through Jesus to Babaji to Master. This is all a particular ray, definable in these terms, very different from other masters, and yet there are so many paths leading up the same mountain. Think of Master not just in terms of personality, think of him rather as an example for how you can live your life and in your way come closer to God. We're not Zen Buddhists, we're not stern, we're not aloof, we're not cold, and I'm not saying that those attitudes are wrong, they aren't our attitudes. What is ours is the way we can grow best, and if we don't focus our minds well and just think we'll take what we like and then take from others what they have to offer, remember, finally, it comes down to a question of magnetism. It isn't anything specific that you do, but when you come into or under this ray of divine grace, without even realizing it, you are accepting into yourself a new divine state of consciousness. It's not yours, it's not mine, it's not Master's, it's God working in this way. Don't feel that it's a human thing. It's a matter of magnetism. Other people's magnetism will be different. Why get mixed up? Get one kind, and remember, however, that that does mean a certain kind of discipline. Some people just don't want to. This was true when Master was alive, too. They didn't want to tune into Master. They didn't want to give up themselves. They didn't want to give up their own ways of thinking and doing things. And they'd have opinions. They'd make statements like, well, I reserve my opinion. I'll consult my inner guidance. And I would put that word guidance in quotes, frankly. Because if they're going to act like that, they're not seeking guidance, they're just seeking their own likes and dislikes. To be a disciple means to be willing to accept discipline. To be a disciple means to be also like a child of the Guru, his offspring. And if we want to really build this work, remember, it isn't just that Master started a beautiful organization and you want to come and take what you can from it, but leave the rest out. It isn't as if, well, Swami has started a beautiful village, let's go there and live there and enjoy it, and we don't care so much about what he's trying to do. We would like the village, we like the communal life, we like the schools. That's not what is going to give you what you've come to really get. Or if you've come for anything else, I remember Master in the end of his life talked the way I'm talking, and I don't know if this means I'm near the end of my life. Sometimes I hope it is, but certainly I'm closer to that than I was a few years ago. But Master was talking exactly the way I am, and people in that time said, just the way some people say now, well, we don't want to follow him, we want to consult our inner selves and our inner feelings and so on. And he would just look at them. He didn't mind. He didn't insist that they follow. He didn't want them to follow. It didn't mean anything to him. But those who came to him and wanted to take what he had to offer were the ones who grew. And I remember, as I said in that letter, he was very, very stern toward the end. And I remember him saying, we only want those who are 100%. And I would be sort of frightened. I think, my God, am I maybe only 99%? I didn't know. I didn't know what this meant. I know now what he meant, that those who just know that they want God, it doesn't mean that they're 100%. There may be some little other things that they have still to work out and so on. But the 100% was that they not in their minds think, well, okay, I'll take his opinion up to a certain point, but I still reserve my own judgment, my own right to decide for myself. Many people will be like that. They aren't real disciples. They're perhaps on the path to becoming disciples, otherwise I'll call them non-disciples. But this is just an inevitable thing that happens. But what we need now is to realize, and I think that the struggles we've had have helped clarify that, because they've forced us and me to really examine what is it that we are. And to speak much more strongly than before, it's had just the opposite effect of what was intended in those lawsuits. We know now that we have a mission, and whereas I've always wanted to say, well, it's just a general mission, it belongs to, it's a part of SRF, it's a part of everything, it's just amorphous, I've disclaimed any personal part in it. Now I have to say and recognize, and I do feel and know, that this is a particular way that Master is working in this world. If you want it, stay with it. If you don't, get out. That's just about how I feel. But I don't say it to frighten you any more than Master really wanted to frighten us when he said we only want those who are, and he shouted it, 100%! But he wasn't doing it unkindly or harshly. He was trying to stiffen our back so that we would really make a strong decision. To be a disciple means to bring into yourself, to accept who he was, recognizing in most cases, I would say not in Master's, and yet Master certainly was not, you can't have a perfect personality. You can have a personality that has achieved perfection, yes. But to say a perfect personality means to define what a perfect personality is. And we see in Master's own life that he and Sri Yukteswar were very different types. Can we say that one was the perfect and ideal human being? If we do, we'd have to say that the other wasn't. Master found it very disconcerting to live with Sri Yukteswar, because Master was so much of the heart. He was so much a lover of God. And Sri Yukteswar expressed himself in terms of cold spiritual mathematics, is the way Master put it. I remember one time I said to Master, I see so much love in Sri Yukteswar's eyes. I'll never forget. Master surprised me. He sort of gave an almost bitter laugh. He said, there was no love in those eyes. And yet, although he had great admiration and respect and love for Sri Yukteswar, they were completely different types. But the beautiful thing that happened was, as Master described in Autobiography of a Yogi, that the more he attuned to Sri Yukteswar, the more he found his own devotional approach to God deepening. So whereas in an outward way he became more like Sri Yukteswar, yes, he did. But yet, in an inward way, that magnetism didn't change him in his deeper self. He became more who he really was, his devotional approach to God became intensified. So don't think that you're really losing yourself when you attune to this ray. What you do is the reality that is you, your own spiritual reality, will become stronger. That magnetism will become deeper. But in an outward way, who are you anyway? People go to the movies and watch a Western, and they come out walking bow-legged as if they were cowboys, sort of ready to take on the sheriff. We borrow our opinions, we borrow our values, we borrow our personalities. Very few people are themselves. The only people who really are the saints. And yet you'll see that the followers of every saint take on also the qualities of that saint as far as their personalities go. I'd say if I have to take on a personality, I would much rather take on Master's personality than anything else. I look back to myself when I was a young man, and I was really very different from what I am now in personality. In my inner nature, no, I'm the same person. You can't change that. You can only refine it. But I remember I used to be quite caustic. I used to be quite sarcastic. I remember one person was giving a concert, and somebody came out and said, "Wasn't that piano playing beautiful?" And I said, "Did you say pitiful?" I was not kindly. I enjoyed barbs, and I was very intellectual and enjoyed word plays and so on. And in many ways, I was somebody whom I look back on with not regret. There's no point in regretting something that you've left, but I certainly have left it. I'm not that person anymore. And people who, I used to be judgmental of people, and I found that it's so much more fun to be like Master in accepting people as they are and loving people as they are. And I don't any longer tend to look down on people for being stupid or lacking good taste or being uneducated or being sort of peasants and so on. I look at Master and I've taken from him that wonderful quality of openness to everybody. I find that my life has been enriched beyond possible imagination by trying to be as much like Master as I can be. But in my way, I don't adopt his accent, I don't adopt his expressions particularly, and yet I do try to feel, and this is my deepest and most constant prayer, may my thoughts be your thoughts. I pray that, I want that, and I find it is more and more true, so that a thought is implanted in my mind that just wouldn't have been there if I hadn't been thinking of him. You will see that the more you can focus yourself on this ray, and that doesn't mean to limit it to Master. It's good to pray to Sri Yukteswar. It's good to pray to Lahiri Mahashai. It's good to pray to Babaji and to Jesus. And from each one you will draw some particular quality, some particular virtue, some particular way of looking at things. This is all right and beautiful. But don't think that by clinging to your own opinion and your own personality, as unattractive as it may be, and imagining that this is you, it is not. You are the eternal spirit, and as long as you're manifesting in this world, why not manifest that particular aspect of this ray that will reach people in the way Master would? So on the one hand, the closer you come to God and Master, the more you will become completely yourself. On the other hand, the more you come to this ray and to these Masters, the more you will find that you become, in a human way also, like them. And your interests and your thoughts and your reactions will be their reactions and will be beautiful because of it. Joy to you, and God bless you.